Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. For John Perkins, confessing was an essential part of his personal wake-up call. Like all confessions, it is the first step toward redemption, he said. Now, it is your turn. You need to make your own confession. When you come clean on who you are, why you are here during this time in history, why you have done the things you have, the ones you are proud of, and those others, and where you intend to go next, you will experience an immediate sense of relief. It may be nothing less than euphoric. John says, believe me, when I say that writing my book has been deeply emotional, and often a painful and humiliating experience. It has been frightening in a way nothing I ever faced before has been frightening, but it has opened me to a sense of relief I have never known until now, a feeling I can only describe as ecstatic. He continues on, he says, ask yourself these questions. What do I need to confess? How have I deceived myself and others? Where have I deferred? Why have I allowed myself to be sucked into a system that I know is unbalanced? What will I do to make sure our children and all children everywhere are able to fulfill the dream of our founding fathers, the dream of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? What course will I take to end the needless starvation and make sure there is never again a day like September 11th. How can I help our children understand that people who live gluttonous, unbalanced lives should be pitied but never, ever emulated, even if those people present themselves through the media they control as cultural icons and try to convince us that penthouses and yachts bring happiness? What changes will I commit to making in my attitudes and perceptions? What forms will I use to teach others and to learn more on my own? These are the essential questions of our time. Each of us needs to answer them in our own way and to express our answers clearly, unequivocally. Payne and Jefferson and all the other patriots are watching over our shoulders. Their words continue to inspire us today. The spirits of those men and women who left their farms and fishing boats and headed out to confront the mighty British Empire, and of those who fought to emancipate the slaves during the Civil War, and of those who sacrificed their lives to protect the world from fascism, speak to us. As do the spirits of the ones who stayed at home and produced the food and clothes and gave their moral support, and all the men and women who have defended what was won on those battlefields. Teachers, poets, artists, entrepreneurs, health workers, the manual laborers, you and everyone. The hour is ours. It is time for each and every one of us to step up to the battle line, to ask the important questions, to search our souls for our own answers, and to take action. The coincidences of your life and the choices you have made in response to them have brought you to this point. By way of epilogue, Confessions of an Economic Hitman was an immediate and unexpected grassroots success that made it to every major bestseller list and has been published in 17 languages. During the 18 months after the book was written, John traveled around the United States and South America. He has talked with people from all walks of life and political persuasions and has received hundreds of emails and letters. The most common response to confessions can be paraphrased as follows, quote, "I knew in my heart that the empire building you described was happening, but everyone told me I was paranoid. Your book has confirmed what I knew. Now I will take action," end quote. A number of people also told John that their initial reaction was anger at him, quote, "You lived a great life as an EHM. Now you've come clean and have a bestseller. Do you expect me to forgive you?" Close quote. They also told him that when they confronted their deeper feelings, they realized that much of their anger was self-directed. "I shop at Walmart, buy Nike shoes, and use too much oil. It's easy to blame you, the politicians, and the corporatocracy. Now I realize that I need to do something positive, and I will." Our nation's history is rife with examples of citizens coming together to enact change. Reflecting the spirit of this determination is an amazing call to action John recently came across in a book he was reading. Quote, "Never was a cause more important or glorious than that which you are engaged in, not only your wives, your children, and distant posterity, but humanity at large, the world of mankind, are interested in it. For if tyranny should prevail in this great country, we may expect liberty will expire throughout the world. Therefore, more human glory and happiness may depend upon your exertions than ever yet depended upon any of the sons of men." End quote. Signed simply, "A Free Man," this message seems very timely. Yet it first appeared in the New England Chronicle in 1775, at a time when Americans were terribly divided over how to deal with an oppressive empire. John was struck by the similarities between that period of history and the current one. The world's most powerful empire then, Great Britain, had overstepped its bounds, refusing to listen to the legitimate complaints of oppressed peoples. The empire responded to desperate acts of rebellion, like the Boston Massacre, with military brutality. Americans were confused. Many believed they had an obligation to support their king, no matter how violent his actions. Many more thought they did not stand a chance at changing the system, a system they had been taught to believe was the most just in history. Those who opposed the empire were labeled as traitors. They were threatened with the hangman's noose. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In reading the diaries of British Revolutionary War soldiers, John discovered that they were impressed by the affluence of America. The land was bountiful, farms prospered. The city seemed like paradise compared to European cities in the 18th century. The soldiers were shocked to see that people who lived such good lives would risk all by defying a government and army that appeared invincible, and in fact was their own government and army. Calls for support, like the ones written by a free man, went a long way to helping Americans understand that they could do better and to inspiring them to take action. The next year, 1776, was a difficult and tumultuous one. American soldiers, lacking clothes, food, shelter, ammunition, leadership, and pay, deserted by the thousands. General Washington and his staff made fatal blunders and lost major battles in and around New York City. A movement to fire him escalated. The revolution was poised to collapse. Thomas Paine had already inspired American patriotism in his pamphlet Common Sense. Once again, he took up his pen. The American crisis appeared on the streets 2 days before Christmas, 1776. Its impact was immediate and profound. Its stirring opening echoes down through the ages to us today. Quote, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." End quote. We have arrived at a similar moment in history. Our own government, in alliance with the big corporations and banks, has created an empire that brings servitude, misery, and death to millions of people. As a result, we who reside within the walls of the empire find ourselves living in constant fear of those who claim the right to defend themselves against what they view as tyranny. We are terrified of suicide bombers, airplane hijackers, and even neighbors hailing from different ethnic backgrounds. We worry about the consequences of sending our young men and women into places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where their lives are in danger and they run the risk of killing innocent civilians. We question the morality of prison camps operated by our military in far-off lands. We suspect that our soldiers are involved in torture, rape, and pillage. We fret that the impacts this war will have on their psyches as well as on world opinion. Many of us are guilty of being sunshine patriots. We know that service to our country is not simply a matter of joining the military or blindly supporting foreign interventions and other policies that favor the corporatocracy. We understand that true patriotism demands that we take action in defense of the principles so eloquently expressed in our most revered documents, those forged by our founding fathers. Loyalty requires that we stand, like American men and women during the Revolution, to oppose the tyranny of empire. Service to our country commands us to take actions that will deserve the love and thanks of men and women for generations to come, actions that will lead to a more equitable and therefore peaceful world. Yet still we defer. We bask in the sunshine of the illusory benefits empire has brought to our shores. As John traveled across the United States after the publication of Confessions, he found people who teetered on the edge of what he came to think of as a modern revolution. He heard them express outrage at our leaders. They recognized the truth that the mainstream press, politicians, and corporate executives are determined to ignore, that Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran and Venezuela and all the other members of the evil axis are not the real problem. The events in those and so many other countries are merely symptoms of a system that, like the British Empire in the 1770s, has run amok. People throughout the land understand that the real problem is a corporatocracy that has grown so selfish and greedy and so entrenched that it threatens the security of the United States and indeed the very survival of our species and many other life forms. In forum after forum and in emails and letters, John heard questions that were deeply disturbing because of what they had to say about the United States and attitudes towards her. Since he suspects that many of us have similar questions, he offers a sample of some of the most frequently asked ones and his responses. The first question is, how come you're still alive? Aren't you afraid that a jackal will silence you? Listen closely to this question. Nothing in Confessions is seditious. John is a loyal American whose forefathers fought in most of our major wars, including the Revolution. He wrote his book because he believes we are a great nation and that we can do much better than to continue building an empire that is hated by millions. He hoped he would inspire us all to improve ourselves and the world our children will inherit. Does that provide grounds for a jackal to come after him? If you believe it does, then you have a responsibility to do something. You must take action. While John has received a few angry letters, he tries not to fear reprisal by the jackals. He knows that he must focus on creating a better world for his daughter and her brothers and sisters around the planet. The fear that we will not create such a world far outweighs his occasional temptation to fear reprisals. He also hopes that the jackals are smart enough to know that the book is already out and that killing him would sell millions more copies. Another question is, have other economic hitmen stepped forward? John says, yes, several EHMs and jackals have contacted him since the publication of Confessions. They've shared their own extraordinary stories about recent events in the Middle East, Latin America, and Africa. Many of them are still connected to the EHM or jackal business, either actively employed or tied in through pensions and retirement funds, or as consultants, and are reluctant to be named. At least one appears ready to write his own book under his own name. What reaction, if any, did John receive from his former association at Maine? He heard from quite a few. Most of these were either employees or other people who, as John described, were not aware of the EHM aspects of the business. They have confided that reading his story has helped them better understand things that went on at Maine that seemed odd and inexplicable to them at the time. Some of those who were named in the book and others who were in positions to know have been hounded by journalists and, as John would expect, have refused to comment. The exception is Einar Greve, the man who recruited John. After leaving Maine, Einar became president of Tucson Electric Power Company and since has retired. He recently granted an interview to the Tucson Citizen. The article states, basically, his story is true, Greve said. What John's book says is there was a conspiracy to pull all these countries on the hook, and that happened. Many of these countries are still over the barrel and have never been able to repay the loans. Close quote. This is similar to what Einar had communicated to John in a letter. He disclosed that he was considering writing his own book on this subject. Several journalists told John that after that article appeared, Einar made statements that seemed to contradict his earlier comments about John's book. This begged the question, what happened to Einar after the Tucson Citizen interview was published? And I'll return after a station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, how about other people in high places? Are any of them speaking out about economic hitmen? John's response is yes. Many insiders have written about the things he exposed in Confessions. In fact, every major event discussed in his book is confirmed by other sources, from Torrijos' assassination to J-Corps' Saudi Arabian money laundering affair. The major difference is that while most of the other authors were executives at the top of the establishments who wrote academic analyses on these subjects, John was a soldier in the trenches. His is a personal, first-person account. Here are several examples of confessions published since 9/11 by people who sat at the top of the pyramid. Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist of the World Bank and winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, said, "Globalization, as it has been advocated, often seems to replace the old dictatorships of national elites with new dictatorships at international finance, to make the IMF's programs seem to work, to make the number add up, economic forecasts have to be adjusted. GDP forecasts are not based on a sophisticated statistical model, or even on the best estimates of those who know the economy well, but are merely the numbers that have been negotiated as part of an IMF program." So that was Joseph Stiglitz. John Henry, former economist of McKinsey & Company and VP for IBM Lotus, said, quote, "The 1970s have been the heyday of the big project paradigm for economic development. Officials from institutions like the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the IDB, the Asian Development Bank, the ADB, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, roamed the globe making huge project loans and preaching the virtues of sophisticated development planning techniques. By 1990, developing countries had accumulated more than $1.3 trillion in foreign debt. In 2000, 86% of the U.S. EXIM banks' $7.7 billion in new foreign export credits and guarantees went to just 10 politically influential U.S. companies, including Enron, Halliburton, GE, Boeing, Bechtel, United Technologies, Schlumberger, and Raytheon." End quote. Next is Jeffrey D. Sachs, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. He said, "More than 8 million people around the world die each year because they are too poor to stay alive. The $450 billion the United States will spend this year on the military will never buy peace if it continues to spend around 1/30 of that, just $15 billion, to address the plight of the world's poorest of the poor, whose societies are destabilized by extreme poverty and thereby become havens of unrest, violence, and even global terrorism." End quote. Then the next question was, why did John not discuss the Clinton administration in Confessions? His response was, during the 1990s, he was running a nonprofit organization, taking groups into the Amazon and being paid as a consultant who did very little except to keep quiet. For him, it was a very different time from the 1980s when, as CEO of an energy company, he was very aware of what was going on with the first Bush administration and George W.'s oil interests. Clinton and John had nothing to do with each other. John did watch with great interest the way the corporatocracy went after him and Hillary during his first term. It seemed like warning shots fired across the bow, and in fact, those warning shots brought many of Clinton's promised programs to a halt. Later, John had to wonder what Clinton had done to convince them to bring Monica out into the public. After all, they have plenty of negatives to expose on all leaders, but only do so when the need arises. But since John was out of the loop, had no inside information, and could only speculate like everyone else, there was nothing for John to confess or that might enlighten others about Clinton. And an important question is the current move to forgive third world debt an indication that the economic hitmen are losing? John's response is, on the contrary, he is sorry to have to say that it shows a new level of sophistication on the part of the EHMs. John certainly favors the idea of forgiving those debts, which, we must remember, were accumulated without the consent of the majority of the people in those countries and served to make the corporatocracy and a few wealthy third world families even richer. But debt forgiveness is not what this is all about. The G8, the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Russia, the World Bank, and the IMF are once again exploiting these nations, and they are calling it debt forgiveness. They are insisting on conditionalities that are cloaked in phrases like good governance, sound economics, and trade liberalization. While the language is enticing, it is also terribly deceptive. These policies are good and sound only if you are looking at them through corporate windows. The countries that agree to such conditionalities are called upon to privatize their health, education, electric, water, and other public services. In other words, sell them to the corporatocracy. They are forced to drop subsidies and trade restrictions that support local businesses, while at the same time accepting that the U.S. and other G8 countries can continue to subsidize certain G8 businesses and erect trade barriers on imports that threaten G8 industries. When Bolivia gave in to such good governance policies, it opened the door for multinationals to privatize its water supply system. Prices of water skyrocketed, and Bolivians claimed that service was suspended to thousands of people. In Côte d'Ivoire, the French firm that bought the assets of the privatized telephone company reportedly raised prices so high that many people had to forego connections to the system, including university students who could not afford internet access essential for their studies. In Tanzania, these policies led to the appalling situation where children have to pay to go to school and many are simply too poor to do so. Similar stories abound in the countries that have accepted the conditionalities that come as a prerequisite to what is being touted as debt forgiveness. One of the shocking things about this new sham is that so many people seem willing to accept it, rather than seeing it for what it truly is, an EHM ploy, and the latest and most subtle step along the road to world empire. The third world, however, is conscious of what is going on, and they are angry. The resistance to the July 2005 G8 meetings in Scotland was, to a large degree, an expression of anger against the deceptions. Many people believed that Blair and Bush were simply playing good guy, bad guy in an attempt to legitimize a highly exploitive system that is balanced heavily in favor of multinational corporations at the expense of the poor, downtrodden, and starving around the world. When will we in the U.S., which is the coach and captain of the G8 corporatocracy team, demand that our leaders fess up to their lies? When will we admit to the deeper truth behind 9/11, the Madrid and London bombings, and so many other acts of violence, that they may be the acts of fanatical murderers, but that they continue to happen only because millions of people are desperate and are silently applauding? When will someone point the finger and say, look, the emperor isn't wearing any clothes? And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.